Greetings and welcome to the Science Podcast for February 22nd, 2008. I'm Stuart Wills, filling in this week for Robert Frederick. In this show, a new expanded view of human genetic diversity, how corporations are getting into the local science education business, and how to move a single atom. All this plus our usual roundup of stories from our free online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, publishers of Science Magazine, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. The American Association for the Advancement of Science at www.aaas.org.
The worldwide genetic diversity of humans is a matter of both basic biology and how humans have moved across the globe over time. DNA studies can provide insights into both dimensions. Now, a team of researchers from Stanford University has put together the largest genetic exploration of human diversity yet. I spoke with two of the study's authors, Richard Myers and Gregory Barsh, about the work and its significance. Dr. Myers began with a quick description of what the work was all about.
What we did was we measured genetic variation in more than a half a million places around the human genome in almost 1,000 people whose DNA had been collected by geneticists over a several decade period led by Luca Cavalli-Schwarz here at Stanford. And this culminated in the formation of a group called the Human Genome Diversity Project. These are the samples that we analyzed. These people are from 51 regions really spread around the world, although they're regions that are not well covered. It shows quite a bit of diversity from around the whole planet. What we did was that by measuring the genetic variation at each of these loci, which is now made possible by very recent technology to do this fast and cheap and accurately, we were able to get a picture of the genetic differences and similarities between people in these populations from around the world at much, much, much greater detail than had been measured before.
So you mentioned the human genome diversity panel that you used. What made that population a particularly good vehicle for studying this kind of thing?
These 51 groups or regions of the world were places where geneticists and anthropologists worked together over several decades collecting DNA samples from individuals who came from those regions. And what's particularly useful about this is that they are from all over the planet, not just in one continent or one region.
Right. What really makes the panel unique and different from what's been done before is the large number of individuals and their diversity in terms of the different regions around the planet where they're from. I think it's worth comparing that to another very large group of individuals that has formed the basis for many disease studies, genetic disease studies. It's called the HapMap. And the HapMap is based on four populations, two of whom are very closely related. And what's different about the HGDP sample is it's based on 51 populations who, when we went into it, we really didn't know how they were related to one another.
So this is potentially a much bigger sort of window into human diversity generally.
Absolutely.
Well, let's drill down now a little bit more into what your group specifically did with these samples. How did you go about studying them to kind of address this problem?
What we did was we took the DNA, and by we, I mean two senior scientists in our group at the Stanford Human Genome Center, Dr. June Lee and Dr. Devin Absher. And what June and Devin did was they took the DNA, and by using a genotyping system, we measured DNA sequence variation at 650,000 loci, or 650,000 regions of the genome that were known to vary in at least the HapMap populations. These are all single nucleotide polymorphisms, or single bases that differ. They'll have either an A or a G, for instance, at a particular position.
So you were starting out with what had already been found about specific parts of the genome where these single nucleotide variations were common, and then you were looking at those specific areas across this larger, more diverse data set.
That's exactly right. And so that we call that genotyping, of course. And so we genotype these individuals, the about 1,000 individuals. We actually chose 1,000 of that set of the Human Genome Diversity Panel that were from the 51 populations, none of whom were related to each other, at least not related to each other in very recent history. Obviously, we're all related to each other, and it's one of the things you learn from this type of study. And so we collected those data, and that actually only took a several-month period for us to do, but then we spent a lot more time analyzing the data.
What are some of the more interesting things that you have found about human genetic diversity and populations in looking at these data?
Well, I think that one of the most interesting things is the realization that we are, in fact, all related to one another. And looking at the way in which these 650,000 places in the genome vary tells us the ways in which we're related. One of the striking things to emerge from the analysis is that many people in populations that we would have thought of as relatively homogeneous actually have ancestors or ancestry from multiple different continents, and that's particularly apparent in the Middle East. And in retrospect, that makes sense because the Middle East, of course, has served as a bridge as early humans migrated out of Africa into Europe. And that's reflected now when we look at the populations that are in the Middle East and we see, well, where are their ancestors from in an agnostic way, that is, you know, let their DNA sequence tell us where their ancestors are from. And we see ancestry in Middle Eastern populations from both Africa and Europe. Another very nice example is the relationship between the Yakut population and Native American populations. And that, of course, makes lots of sense when we think about the origin of Native American populations. I think it's also worth stating explicitly that the study adds to the now, I would say, overwhelming support that we have for the notion of where humans are from initially. That is, early humans really first appeared in Africa and then populated the rest of the world as they migrated out of Africa.
Well, we've talked a bit about population. Does this help us also in genomic medicine?
Having the ability to understand the genetic variation within groups will help us in genetic disease studies. One of the biggest problems, and I'll let Greg elaborate on this, but one of the biggest problems is that when you don't take population or geographic origin into account in a large genetic study for studying something like heart disease, one of the complex traits, for instance, you end up confounding the study such that you don't actually get real signals.
It's clear that many important common human diseases vary in their incidence among different populations. And sometimes that clearly is due to culture. For example, the incidence of obesity in Western society. You know, other times it's probably due to genetic differences between populations. And many times it's probably due to a combination of environment and ancestry. And figuring out what the ancestry is for any human on the planet is really a prerequisite to deconvoluting the interrelationship between ancestry and environment in understanding common human diseases.
Gregory Barsch and Richard Myers are the authors, with 9 colleagues, of a new study that provides the most detailed description to date of human genetic diversity. The paper appears in the February 22nd issue of Science. And speaking of diversity, Science podcast editor Robert Frederick was at the AAAS 2008 annual meeting last weekend in Boston, from which he posted 10 short podcasts on diverse topics ranging from the evolution of morality to the challenges of building a sustainable bioeconomy. If you haven't checked out those shows yet, be sure to visit our podcast page at sciencemag.org/multimedia/podcast. Meanwhile, in other podcast news, Science Signaling, the online journal and knowledge environment devoted to the science of cell signaling, posts its second Signaling podcast this week. In that show, the Science Signaling editors talk about how high circulating concentrations of glucose, a condition associated with diabetes and obesity, may stimulate muscle stem cells to differentiate into fat-storing cells, or adipocytes. Look for the show on the Science Signaling homepage at stke.sciencemag.org. Policymakers and politicians often decry the low quality of science, technical, engineering, and math education, or STEM education, in U.S. primary and secondary schools. Now, as Science Deputy News Editor Jeff Mervis reports in a cover article in this week's issue, some for-profit corporations are also getting into the act in a big way. They're pouring money, time, and leadership into local school programs focused explicitly on science and math. He's in the studio with me now. Jeff, welcome.
Good to be here, Stuart.
Well, Jeff, you know, as you note in your article, corporations have actually been supporting education, and especially STEM education, for many years. But I gather that there's something new here. What is this new twist?
What's new is what you could call in-your-face philanthropy. Companies have complained for a long time that they're not getting the kind of trained workers that they need in order to do the kind of research and technology development. But in the past, they've done that at a distance. They have supported things like science fairs, or they've supported other organizations. Now they're deciding to step in and take an active role in schools, in their communities, and in school districts across the country.
Isn't this just really PR, though? I mean, or is there really something else going on here?
I think it's more than that. There are a lot of reasons, and certainly getting the corporate name out in front is one reason. But I think there's a lot of CEOs and boards that are very concerned, and they think that they have the talent and the skills and the resources to make a difference. American education is a $500 billion enterprise, so companies can't match that amount of money, but they feel that strategically investing a few million or even tens of million could make a big difference.
So that's this kind of notion of strategic philanthropy that you discuss in your article.
Correct.
You know, I noticed in your article that a number of these company efforts work through the mechanism of charter schools. I was wondering if you could just tell us about a few of those efforts.
Sure. Well, I don't think it's a coincidence. The charter school movement provides much more flexibility for schools to get money from outside non-government sources. These are public schools, but the principals and the teachers have much more flexibility. So companies are finding those schools much more receptive, one, because they need the money, and two, because they can have a much bigger say in the curriculum and even the hiring of teachers.
And there was an interesting program you especially focused on by a company, I think it was called Exelon.
Right. Exelon is a big utility company. They operate nuclear power plants and other utilities in Chicago. And Chicago also happens to be a school district that's trying to reform, and they have a goal of 100 charter schools. Well, Exelon and their CEO, John Rowe, decided to contribute $4 million, which created a math and science academy. And so, naturally, Exelon has played a big role in helping that school get off the ground. It just opened in September.
And there's another sort of different approach by Motorola that you talked about as well.
Right. Motorola, another, you know, big electronics company in the Chicago area, is working with another organization that runs charter schools, but they're doing it in a little bit more thoughtful way. They're working with professors at the Illinois Institute of Technology who have developed a math and science curriculum, and they're going to be opening up a middle school charter school in the fall.
Well, you know, it's interesting. For-profit companies, you know, by their very nature, tend to be kind of bottom-line oriented, but I imagine it must be rather hard to measure results in an undertaking like this.
It is hard, and companies have taken different approaches. Ernst & Young, for example, the huge accounting and consulting firm, has decided that its employees should get involved and want to get involved. So one of the ways they're measuring results is in how much participation they get from their employees. Other companies have done a more traditional approach, bringing in an outside evaluator to try to measure student achievement, improvement in teacher understanding of the subject, and that sort of thing. But those are long-term efforts, and you don't see results overnight.
Well, that could spell difficulty in this kind of results-oriented corporate culture. I mean, do you think these companies are going to stay in this for the long haul?
Well, that's the big question. The school officials certainly hope so. And all the company executives that I talked to made that same point, that we are in it for the long haul. But the economy being what it is, some of these efforts will have to be reexamined every year or even every quarter.
Well, I'm sure you'll be back to tell us more. Jeff Mervis, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for your interest.
Jeff Mervis is a deputy news editor with Science. He writes about new approaches to corporate support for science education in the journal's February 22nd issue. Elsewhere on the education front, can improved access to education spur a country's overall economic growth? It seems to make intuitive sense. Yet, although it's been well established that better education leads to better incomes for individuals, the evidence linking a country's education levels with its economic growth has been surprisingly weak, until now. That's the word from the authors of a policy forum in this week's Science, who look at a new data set that tracks educational attainment by age and sex in 120 countries. The new data show that education does matter economically, but only the right kind of education. Specifically, the data suggests that the UN's Millennium Development Goal of universal primary education, while laudable, may not be enough to pull the world's poorest societies out of poverty. Instead, a commitment to expand both primary and secondary education may hold the key. Read The Demography of Educational Attainment and Economic Growth in the February 22nd issue of Science. How do you move an individual atom across a surface? To do that, you need to know something about the forces involved, and measuring those forces is a tricky proposition at the atomic scale. Now, an international team led by Andreas Heinrich has pulled off that feat by combining two powerful techniques into one instrument. They've published the result in a paper in this week's Science, and I spoke with the first author on that study, Markus Ternes, to learn a bit more.
Actually, atom manipulation is not something really new. I mean, scientists all over the world are doing this now almost since 20 years. And you might ask why is this important, but during these 20 years, a lot of basic fundamental results came out of this. You can imagine that you can, for example, study the interactions on atoms and molecules on the surface just by moving them around and bringing them, for example, closer, or to perform step-by-step chemical reactions. One ingredient of this understanding was missing during this period. It was never possible to really to measure the forces to manipulate atoms. And I think this will bring us a deeper understanding on interactions on a surface. And it might also help to develop techniques to build nanostructures on the atomic level.
So people were able to manipulate these atoms, but they didn't actually know the precise forces involved?
Right. They couldn't detect forces on these kind of spatial resolution.
So I gather that you've now accomplished this, and you've done that by essentially putting together two different kinds of instruments or two different kinds of techniques. Is that right?
That's right. Because, I mean, there is an instrument out also already there since almost 25 years, which allows to measure tiny forces on the atomic scale, the so-called atomic force microscope. But to combine this, to measure the force you need to move an atom, we had to combine this with an STM, which is the standard tool to manipulate atoms.
An STM being a scanning tunneling microscope.
Right. But this scanning tunneling microscope is very precise and down to a picometer and smaller length scales, but it can't detect forces. So we had to combine these two tools actually to perform atom manipulation as we wanted to do this, plus to detect the forces involved.
And so how do you actually know when you've reached the threshold of force to actually move an atom? How does this actually work?
Actually, it works like this. atoms bond to a surface on certain locations. That's known. And we know neighboring locations where the atom bonds. So it's not like rolling a marble over a flat surface. It can only stick on certain positions. So what we did, we just used our fine tip to move along this preferred direction in different heights over the atom. So now you can imagine if we are far enough away with our tip, then the action force is not strong enough. But if we come closer and closer, step by step, only a few picometers closer to the atom, then on a certain point, the interaction force between the tip apex and the atom on the surface is large enough, and we see this hop happening. And with this time-consuming method, I have to say, we can detect exactly, precisely on a picometer scale at which position and which forces are involved when this hop actually happened.
So you kind of very slowly zoom in on the atom, if you will. And what did you actually find in terms of results when you did this?
Well, one point we found was, of course, that the force you need depends very much on the system you study. But this is not really surprising. But what was really surprising for us was that we found the threshold where the atom hops at first. But then we decreased the distance, so we brought the tip closer to the atom, which strongly increases this short-range force between them. And what we found is, which is surprising, that the only thing which matters in our systems is the lateral force. So even if the overall vertical force is changed by a factor of 5 or so, only the lateral component, makes actually the atom hop.
So in terms of actually, if you will, dragging an atom across a surface, it's the lateral force only, and that's independent of the vertical force.
That's right, at least in our range of forces we measured it.
Well, Dr. Turnus, maybe we could just close here with a few thoughts on where you think this work takes us.
I think it definitely gives us a deeper insight in atomic manipulation in general. And atomic manipulation is something, for example, important for understanding tribology, the friction on the single atomic scale, which wasn't done in such an extent until now. I think it's also important to say that this tool now allows us to build structures on insulators, because the FPM relies on the fact that you have a conductive surface. So with this tool, we can build structures on insulator, but still use the powerful tool FPM to detect electronic or magnetic structures, magnetic properties on these then constructed systems.
All right. Well, Dr. Marcus Turnus, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Marcus Turnus is the first author on a new paper on measuring the lateral forces required to move a single atom across a surface. Read the paper in this week's Science. Also this week in Science, the biology behind a case of extreme mimicry. Throughout the larval phase of its existence, the swallowtail butterfly is a master of deception. Its youngest caterpillars are a dead ringer for a glistening pile of bird droppings, while later larvae are color-coded to blend into the surrounding leaves. A new Brevia article in Science now demonstrates that a single hormone, juvenile hormone, or JH, acts as a master switch that regulates this spectacular change in appearance. Not only does JH govern the overall color shift, it also appears to regulate exoskeletal structures and even specific markings on the insect. The finding suggests that JH could be an important switch for the larval patterns of other insects, too. Read the paper in the February 22nd edition of Science. Well, finally today, David Grimm, the editor of Science's free online daily news service, Science Now, joins us to talk about the latest science stories. David, what's on the menu for today?
Well, Stuart, I've got three stories for you. We'll talk about a new danger for emperor penguins, sea lions, and other creatures at the Earth's poles, how a spacecraft heading towards Pluto is going to catch a lucky break, and finally, how anticipation influences everything from how we feel about chocolate to true love.
Well, that sounds like a great lineup. Let's start with what sounds like bad news for the creatures of the deep southern hemisphere.
Well, Stuart, this is another global warming story, and this has to do with, as you said, the creatures that live in the southern hemisphere. And the observation is that about 20 times over the past 2 million years, there's been a global deep freeze that really plunged the planet into very cold temperatures.
It's kind of the opposite of a global warming
episode. Exactly, the opposite of a global warming episode. And during this period, the creatures that lived in these Antarctic areas were able to adapt by either moving into deeper waters, which also happened to be warmer, and also penguins, or the more terrestrial animals, were able to follow the expanding ice into warmer climes. And so they were able to adapt to these colder climates. But researchers studying fossil evidence have begun to worry that although these creatures were able to adapt to colder climates, that adaptability may not carry over to warmer climates.
And why would that be?
Well, it's a great question, Stuart. And the answer is that these creatures are so well adapted to the cold that actually makes them ill-adapted to the warm. And they really wouldn't be able to go to colder waters because there wouldn't be colder waters to go to. And another problem is predators. Predators like sharks and large crabs will be moving into these warming waters where they would naturally be. And in the past, when this has happened, these Antarctic creatures have had time to adapt. But researchers worry that the warming we're experiencing now is happening so rapidly that a lot of these creatures are not going to have time to adapt. So not only are they going to have trouble dealing with the warming temperatures themselves, but they're going to face the added danger of dealing with all of these new predators in their ecosystems.
So the news just keeps getting worse and worse on global warming.
Unfortunately so.
Well, let's move to somewhat better news, I guess on a much smaller scale, the New Horizons probe.
Right. New Horizons is a spacecraft that's heading towards Pluto and is expected to arrive there in about 2015. And astronomers are interested in a whole lot of things about Pluto. But one of the things they're really interested in is Pluto's unique atmosphere. And what makes Pluto's atmosphere unique is that it appears and disappears.
That's quite a trick. How does that work?
It is quite a trick. The atmosphere is made up primarily of methane and nitrogen. And when Pluto is close to the sun, these elements exist in a gaseous form, thus forming Pluto's atmosphere. But as Pluto moves farther and farther away from the sun, as it's doing now, it gets colder and colder. Its atmosphere gets colder and colder. And this methane and nitrogen get so cold that they solidify and fall to the surface as ice and snow.
So Pluto's atmosphere freezes when it's too far
away. It freezes and essentially collapses and disappears. And the astronomers that are sending New Horizons out have been really worried, will New Horizons get there in time? Because Pluto's moving away from the sun, will New Horizons get there in time to catch this atmosphere? And according to one of our reporters who talked to an astronomer at the AAAS meeting in Boston last week, it turns out New Horizons should catch a lucky break. Observations made in 2002 show that even though Pluto's moving away from the sun, its atmosphere is still expanding, which is good news. And observations made just last year show that Pluto's atmosphere is actually not cooling down as fast as astronomers had feared. So it shouldn't reach that critical cold point that would cause the atmosphere to freeze and disappear by the time New Horizons gets there. So when the spacecraft does arrive at Pluto, it should have plenty to study.
So a relief for the New Horizons scientists, if nothing else.
Exactly.
Well, finally, a story I've been anticipating since you mentioned it, how anticipation fires the imagination.
Right. And this is another story from the AAAS meeting that happened in Boston last week. And I guess the best way to do this is to start with an example. Say you just took a test and you didn't feel like you did so great on it. You thought maybe, yeah, I feel like I got like a C or a D on that test. And if you were thinking that way, you'd go, well, you know, if I got a B on that test, I'd feel great because I thought I'd do really bad on it. But say you actually get the test back in a few weeks and you do get a B on it. For some reason, that B doesn't feel as good as you thought it would.
So this is about why the real event doesn't live up to the anticipation.
Exactly. And scientists have been trying to figure out why. Why do our expectations often not match reality? And one group of scientists thinks it has something to do with anticipation. And what they did was they took 60 students from Harvard, and they had them eat potato chips. But it wasn't just eating potato chips. The students were presented with a tray that had potato chips on one side and either chocolate or a can of sardines on the other side.
Well, that sounds a lot like what I was eating in graduate school anyway.
Exactly. And what the researchers wanted to test was, would the students think that the chips tasted better when they were next to the sardines versus when they were next to the chocolate? And they divided the students into two groups, what they called predictors and experiencers. And as they expected, the predictors, who actually didn't taste the chips, said, hey, when I see the chips next to the sardines, I think those chips are going to taste really good. But when I see the chips next to the chocolate, I don't think those chips are going to taste quite as good. What they found was the students that actually ate the chips rated them about the same in quality, whether they were next to the chocolate or whether they're next to the sardines. And what the researchers think is happening is when you actually have the experience you're anticipating, your mind is so busy with the experience that it's not really thinking about the alternative. So when you're tasting the chips, you're so wrapped up in that experience that you're not thinking, hey, I could have had sardines instead, or hey, I could have had chocolate instead.
Well, did they test that as well? I mean,
well, so right, they wanted to test, they wanted to see how this anticipation factor plays in. And so what they did was they ran another experiment and they told the students, eat the chips slowly. So instead of just scarfing down the whole bag, eat maybe one chip every 45 seconds. Give your brain time to think about everything that's going on. And when they did that, they found that when the students eat the chips slowly, if they were confronted with chocolate and chips, they didn't think the chips tasted so good anymore. And when they were confronted with sardines and chips, those chips tasted pretty good.
So they had time to think about how much better chocolate is than potato chips.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, that's very interesting. A story that, if nothing else, proves that potato chips still have something to teach us.
Exactly.
Well, David, thanks very much.
Thanks, Stuart.
What else can we expect to see on Science Now in the next few days?
Well, Stuart, we're looking into a few stories. One on using human embryonic stem cells to help treat diabetes. Another story on some of the drawbacks of using solar energy and why those drawbacks might not be as bad as some people think. And finally, a way to geoengineer the climate using aerosols.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the free online daily news service of science. You can check out the latest science stories at sciencenow.sciencemag.org. And that wraps up the February 22nd, 2008 Science Podcast. Our usual host, Robert Frederick, will be back at the helm next week. Meanwhile, if you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine and of AAAS, the Science Society. The content is provided by the news and editorial staff of Science, and Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Stuart Wills. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.